everybody. This is The Thing About Cars. Welcome to this episode. I'm one of your hosts, Mickey. Around the table, we have, I think, the entire gang again. Dawn, are you there?
I am here.
Hey, Becca.
I'm here also.
Ben?
I'm here.
Dave?
I'm here in spirit only.
Only in spirit. Ah, okay. And our longtime friend and contributor, Tim. Tim, are you present?
I am present. Thank you.
Welcome, Tim. So welcome, everybody. Thanks for joining us for this episode of The Thing About Cars. Let's start off this episode with a moment of Grand Trivia Auto. In fact, I read something that I don't think we're going to turn into trivia, but I thought I'd throw it out for conversation's sake real quick before we get to the actual trivia question. A lot of people know that the Ford Model T was the first mass-produced and affordable car in the world. And here on The Thing About Cars, we've talked about it was actually Carl Benz, the founder of Mercedes-Benz cars, who made the first ever workable car. It was a three-wheeler, but he beat Henry Ford to the punch in terms of actually inventing and making the car. But what a lot of us have never talked about here on the show was that it was his wife who was the actual first regular driver of the car. So the first person to actually drive a mass-produced car was Bertha Benz, a woman. Women drove cars before men did, in other words, is what I'm trying to say.
That's awesome. But the way you said it was a woman.
A woman.
And you know what? That's going to fit in great with what I'm going to talk about later. So thanks it's for really teeing that up. Yes.
It well, is. Personally, I you am in love with the name Bertha Benz.
Bertha Benz is an awesome name. Yeah.
B.
So the way I read the story here is it says that Bertha drove Carl Benz's creation for 106 kilometers at 66 miles without his permission. So she forged the road and paved it for all of us. And I've got more information. She took a trip from Mannheim to Forsheim, which was illegal at that time, and just to be able to prove that it was the first time someone could drive an automobile for greater distances, and that's why she should continue with his work.
Go Bertha.
I was about to say the same thing, Don.
Go Bertha.
Way to go, Bertha.
Yeah, I think so too. Good for her. Good for all of us too. So for now, for our moment of Grand Trivia Auto, what animal sometimes appeared often in groups of three on Ford badges from the 1950s to the 1970s? Was it cats or tigers? Was it bears, birds, or chupacabra?
Lions, tigers, and bears. Oh my.
You need me to read the choices again?
Please.
So what animal sometimes appeared often in groups of three on Ford badges from the 1950s to the 1970s? Was it bears, birds, chupacabras, or cats and tigers? Cats/tigers, I guess. I don't know.
Felines.
Felines, yes. So we'll answer that question at the end of the show. I never actually knew that Ford would have ever have picked an animal to represent their brand at all. And I was even alive in the 70s, and I don't remember this. So
I think I remember it.
Yeah. I think.
So we'll think on it.
All right. And now for Becca's segment with today's episode. Becca, are we still calling it Relationship Roadster?
Side note, this is... what I was typing up in chat and what I was going to ask, because you said you weren't starting the recording yet. and then I read that thing the other day and I thought we weren't doing the Relationship Roadster. I continued on with the news thing like we had talked about.
Yes, still needs a name news thing.
As far as I knew that Becca wasn't going to be joining us and it was for her and I don't know. I'm confused. I'm just here for the ride.
Right. Aren't we all?
So I have news, and that's what I hadn't quite inserted into the document yet.
I see. Okay. So the Fix or Repair Daily segment.
Yes. The Fix or Repair Daily, blah, blah. And I gave it some sub-segment names today.
Oh, yeah?
So I had news in the fast lane, just some quick little news stories. Yeah. One of them is about a 1971 Datsun 240Z. If you're a fan of the Z car and have some money burning a hole in your pocket, you currently have one day left to place a bid on this. It's a low mileage, fully restored 1971 Datsun 240Z. It's the auction is on bringatrailer.com. The last bid currently is at 111,000.
Oh,
that's what makes it news right there. You knew you were waiting for it, right?
Dotson.
111,000. But not to fear, if you're a big fan of the Dotson cars, you can't quite afford 111,000. There are currently 7 other Dotsons up for auction on the same site, which is, I didn't expect 7, well, 8 Dotsons same time. You don't hear of them much. But also on a side note, if you really love me, there's currently a 1972 resto mod Ford Bronco for sale on bringatrailer.com. And it's at 25,000 right now. So, wow. You know, if you love me, you need to buy me a gift. Don't know what to get me. I'm just saying.
I love you, baby, but I ain't got $25,000.
For 111. For 111,000, I could buy a beat up old Z, fix it up into a really nice, you know, custom V8 job, and still have the 25 grand left to buy the Bronco.
There you go. Well, there were a number of cars. I was kind of losing my mind over all the side notes I could have made just for you guys. There's a Lotus Elan out there. There's quite a number of very interesting cars on bringatrailer.com right now.
Yes.
So you guys definitely want to check that out.
Wow.
If I can talk. I need my meds too.
Yeah, both of us need meds.
Good cheap.
Yeah, we pool our resources and just take all the meds.
Also, if you're a driver in California, you need to watch out. Cruise, which is the self-driving tech company backed by GM and Honda, has announced that it received a permit from the California DMV to test its prototype on the state's roads without a safety driver behind the wheel.
No way.
So I'm not ever visiting California. It's pretty much where I'm at on that one.
Did you all read the article that part of the problem that the autonomous vehicles have is they're too polite? They don't know how to actually get aggressive to get into traffic. And so sometimes they back up traffic on like on ramps for days.
Yeah.
No.
Oh my God.
Sitting there. I don't know how I'm going to feel when I see a driverless vehicle. Like, I haven't seen one yet.
It's kind of like a monorail, but with no rail, right? It just kind of comes along. It does its thing. It stops. The doors open. People get in and out, and then it moves.
But a monorail is safe because it's on a rail.
That is true.
And it's not next to me. And I want to say obscene things to it. And you're looking, going, trying to get someone's attention, like, move over, buddy. And there's nobody to move over. There's nobody.
So, Dave, you're saying we need to teach one of these things to flip everyone else off.
Yeah, it's we've been worried about, like, you know, computers and robots, you know, the evil robot, iRobot type thing that's going to, you know, take over the world.
Oh, the Terminator.
Yeah, it's just the opposite. It's we got to actually, we got to bastard them up a bit.
Oh my. Yeah, it's like instead of rogue robots, we have Mr. Belvedere.
You'll need to be able to order your driverless car with a middle finger option.
Yeah,
right. Exactly. Here's my other comment, which is, okay, why do we need to dirty up the nice kid in town? Why can't we all just play nice with the new guy?
Oh, how sweet.
If we're going to wildly veer off tangent, something somebody just said a minute ago, I don't think I've mentioned it on the podcast at any point. I've recently pretty badly damaged my left arm. And I'm still working on getting most control of it back. But one thing I have noticed is I'm no longer able to flick somebody off with my left hand.
Wow.
And that's driving me crazy because that's where the window is.
You might as well just give up driving in Atlanta.
I have to reach over with my right hand to flick people off.
You just get an autonomous vehicle and you can sit in the passenger seat and use your right hand.
I'm flicking you off now.
Becca, what you need is a sunroof.
I have a sunroof.
Oh, okay. Well, then there you go. That's your right hand window.
It's also on a Jeep, which is higher up, and people wouldn't see it unless they're in a higher up. I don't know.
Right. Yeah. The Miata driver is never going to see you.
All right. So the last one for news in the fast lane, the Honda Civic that we've brought up a couple of times before, they're getting a complete new overhaul for the 2022 model year. They're expecting a new exterior design, a more modern cabin. I think we've touched on it before. The two-door coupe is gone for good, which is, you know, weird to me because I always felt like the Civic was the two-door option and the Accord was the four-door, you know, excluding the Prelude, which was the more sporty. It seemed like they all had a niche at one point, and now, I don't know, everything's four-door, I guess. But the two-door coupe is gone for good, and the one that I found the most shocking, according to Motor Trend, it will no longer have the option for a manual transmission.
Yeah.
And that to me, I mean, when I was growing up, if you were going to learn a stick shift, more often than not, it was a Honda. You know, it just, it was the almost always stick shift kind of car. And it blows my mind that it will never have that option again. It's going to be all automatic.
You know, I'm torn on the matter. I learned how to drive stick on a Volkswagen, a Scirocco, as a matter of fact, back in like 86. But there's a part of me that's not going to miss stick shift a whole lot. It's just, why do we miss it? Why do we need to, you know, overly complicate the driving thing for people?
Well, because I still believe that people need to learn the entire, you know, the entire gambit of driving instead of learning on a car that has all these bells and whistles and everything.
But when you pick up a computer, you don't expect people to learn how to program it.
And you
I'm not asking you to build the car. I'm asking you to drive the car.
Yeah, but it is an interesting dichotomy because we also don't crank our vehicles anymore.
We call it that, though. It won't crank.
We also do that.
Has anybody ever wondered where that came from?
Yes.
Because cars used to actually have a crank at the front of the car.
Well, right. We do crank it, just not directly by hand.
Well, I'm saying it's not. We're not cranking it in the literal. There's
no more hand crank.
Exactly. On the front of the car where you crank it up and then go get in the car. And yeah.
We also no longer, you know, manually advance the ignition timing, which, you know, was a thing back in the 1920s.
Right.
Ben, you beat me to it.
You don't have to buy your own batteries because they come with the car and an accelerator.
Or just the mixture.
Actually, though, in the adjusting the mixture, everybody's heard me complain about going to carburetor on my Mustang, and you can adjust a carburetor. But as far as advancing the timing, once the computers got more involved, yes, it was difficult to do anything with the timing. But my Mustang does have the Steeda ignition timing gear installed on her, and I can go out there with that gear and manually adjust the timing.
But it's not something you do going down the road, right?
No, it's not. But considering how most cars are now, it's still a lot more than that.
Right. Yeah. One thing about driving a stick shift is it's a more engaged driving experience.
Exactly.
I agree.
Yeah. Whereas, and the progression automatics has, I guess, come along with the, making automobiles in general more of an appliance than the more romantic piece of equipment that it had been in the past.
Well, see, to me, my car is like, you know, a mech warrior or something. It's an extension of me. It's the suit of armor I'm wearing. I want to have full control and, like, I don't know. It's an extension of me as opposed to this appliance that I'm using.
So Tim is saying that he is really a romantic, and Becca is saying that she needs to get her hand on a stick.
Yes, I do.
I'm still married.
So you play with your own stick then.
Right.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. We've gone far off track. So let's circle back around. Circle back around for my my bigger story that I'm calling
real quick.
It,
yep.
That I'm calling, oops, I did it again.
Okay.
You may recall the name Takata from the now infamous airbag recall.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, now there might be another recall. Joyson Safety Systems purchased a large portion of Takata's assets after they went bankrupt, has been reviewing some things and has found some inaccuracies in seatbelt webbing test data reports.
Ooh.
And I don't remember the official name of what they were giving it. The Japanese Motor Safety Authority has already warned automakers to prepare for a recall of the Takata seatbelts. They're still investigating how many cars might have these, though. Sorry, I was trying to put this together so I could read it smoothly, and I'm all over the place, but it could potentially affect a lot of cars. JSS Now, who used to, you know, took over Takata, they account for 40% of the seatbelt market in Japan and 30% worldwide. They are working to identify who they think might be affected. Let me see. I was reading this one interesting thing. Honda is obviously a big user of the was Takata systems, but they also export out. Some of the companies that they had listed was like GM, and they had even listed Ferrari as being consumers. The only two companies that had really sent in any sort of response to the situation is Toyota and Honda. They both make statements similar to, we're working to identify if any of our cars are impacted by this seatbelt recall. But so it's, yet another Takata problem that everybody is trying to deal with. But the company actually, after the whole airbag recall, which apparently is the largest automotive safety recall ever, they pleaded guilty to criminal wrongdoing over its inflators by submitting false inflator test results to automaker clients to induce them to buy the defective products.
Wow.
So when they say inaccuracies in the data, it sounds weird. Like, what do you mean? But it's exactly what happened with the airbags, and now it's happening with the seatbelts. So I'm not sure what that means for JSS when they buy the assets, they kind of buy everything that comes along with it, but they're looking into it, trying to find out who's impacted, and everybody just kind of watch out and make sure your car isn't involved in it.
Yeah, no kidding.
Oh
man, so somebody screwed up big time.
Well, they were deliberately doing it. That's the thing, that Takata was deliberately doing it. JSS is now finding these issues and having to scramble to find out who's affected, how to notify people and get everything resolved. But who knows what they're going to keep finding.
Right.
You know, so it was stated, it was deliberately done by Takata, that they knew the equipment was defective. They deliberately used falsified data in order to sell the defective products.
Right. Oh God.
That's awful.
That is awful.
I mean,
Exactly.
Well, let's try to change the subject back and bring it back to a little element of levity.
But important, yeah. Though. I mean, yeah, that was kind of doom and gloom, but I mean, it's important for people to know things like that.
It's very important.
Do you think that people have to wait to get notified, or do you think they could take their cars in?
They are definitely going to have to wait. I mean, if they haven't identified specific brands or models or anything yet, there's definitely no official recall issued. Everybody's going to shrug. If you take your car in and panic, people are going to shrug and say, I don't know.
Right. Right.
So they're all working on it. Just keep your eyes and ears peeled. Yeah.
Wait for them to come to us.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh boy. Well, on that note, Tim, how you doing?
Doing great.
Good.
Thank you. You've
been out of the races recently.
I just got back from Petit Le Mans yesterday.
Yeah. Did you see anything interesting?
A lot of cars going very fast. Most of them staying on track.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. Tim, Ben, have you ever been?
Not to that event, no.
Okay. We need to make it a point to go.
Yeah.
This was the 25th year of the Petit Le Mans race, which is a 10-hour sports car race, professional sports car race.
Were you there for the entire 10 hours?
Yes.
Wow. Were you awake for the entire 10 hours?
Awake and riveted. Yes. Yeah. It was good competition. After 10 hours of racing, the lead for the top two placing cars was less than a second until one of them tried to pass the other, and the third place car took over for the win.
What makes, Le Mans is a particular class of car, right?
Right. It's for prototype sports cars and production-based sports cars.
So what stood out to you?
The prototype sports cars, the top two competitors were teams from Acura and Cadillac. Who knew that Cadillac made race cars, right?
Yeah, no kidding.
But of course, these are prototype cars, so they're the only thing that's truly production-based is the motor. But they're also in the top-level production-based class was the big race really between Corvettes, BMWs, and Porsches, and each one of the marks was represented at different times at the in the lead throughout the course of the race. So
right.
it really came down to a lot of good back and forth. But the great thing that I enjoy about it is that the production based cars are truly production based. The actual chassis of the car came off the assembly line. So.
Right. Right. Very cool. I hope to see one of these events in person one day. I think that'll be very cool.
Yeah.
So we're doing this new thing with the show. Every one of our guests has to answer a small handful of standardized questions.
Okay.
These are four, generally quick questions. My first question for you is, what is your dream car?
Oh, boy. Well, if you have to go cost, no object.
Cost, no object. Yeah.
Yeah. Because it is a dream, right?
Yeah.
I've always been fond of Ferraris.
Okay.
So, growing up, it would have been the Testarossa. Yeah. Right now, probably be the 488. I might even be a generation behind.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the current flagship model is. Question number two: where is your next road trip?
Let me tell you about my last road trip. which was from Metro Atlanta to Bryson City, North Carolina.
Ah.
So the drive fun was home. The most interesting part of the drive was the drive home. On one part, we were on a gravel road that parallels the Little Tennessee River, and after 3 days of rain, the Little Tennessee had raised enough to match the height of the gravel road that we were on.
Oh my goodness.
Yes, like literally within 2 inches. So
no, oh wow,
yeah,
that would freak me out to no end. I have dreams like that. I have dreams of driving along roads, and all of a sudden the water is much higher than it used to be.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I have to ask, what took you up to North Carolina?
My in-laws have a cabin up in the mountains up there.
Ah, very nice. Very nice.
Yeah, nice relaxing weekend.
Yeah, very cool. Question number three: what's the weirdest thing you've seen in someone's garage?
Wow. For as far as weird goes, can we go cool instead?
Yeah, sure. Why not?
I was at a friend of mine invited me to a party, and a gentleman who was hosting the party, who I had not previously met, had a 1980s Porsche 962 race car.
Wow.
Yeah, so the 962 was the top of the line prototype sports car that won 24 hours of Daytona, 24 hours of Le Mans, multiple years in that GTP era of road racing.
Cool. Yeah. Very cool. Yeah.
Sweet.
Nice.
Actually, I'm wondering if I've got the weirdest thing in my garage right now.
Yeah, well.
Is it a body?
Shh, you're not supposed to talk about the body.
Is it part of your left arm?
Oh my goodness, I wish it would be a new left arm at this point. I actually have a pet mouse at the moment in the garage.
Oh.
Well, caged, that's how he stays. Caged.
It's caged.
Okay.
Oh.
It's because their mice had gotten into my garage, and before I released them, I wanted to catch both of them to release them together, and I've only caught one so far. I'm wondering if the other one just ran away at this point. But so I have one in a cage waiting for me to catch the other one. So
are
I
you
have
feeding it?
Am I heating it? No.
Feeding.
Yes, I am feeding it.
So let me get this straight. You are actually engaging in a mouse hostage situation.
Yes, I am.
Yes. Yes. You've either caught Mickey and you're trying to entice Minnie, or vice versa.
I believe I have Minnie, and I'm looking for Minnie. Because the other one was smaller, so I was assuming it was spawn of Minnie.
Then mom
or she likes said, little guys.
Get the hell out of here. Yeah.
Yeah.
Who knows? Oh. Maybe she's a cougar.
This is very true. Very true.
Okay. See, and I'm just kind of impressed that you actually live caught the mouse, because in my world, it would be like, you know, all my means of mice catching are kind of lethal.
Well, I don't like hurting animals, but my children would definitely be very angry at me if I had done that. And yeah. And putting out poison, I've learned from my parents' mistakes that if a mouse eats poison, yeah. it's going to go find a little crack or crevice to die in, usually the air vents. Yeah. And then you will spend months looking for the dead body. And where is that smell coming from?
So you're saying you actually do have a body in your garage?
No, I life caught it. It's in a cage. I'm feeding
a live
it.
Body.
She's happy and healthy as far as I know, and waiting on the other one.
I said we'd name her Bertha.
I'm going to release her. I'm not keeping her. This thing is crazy.
I mean, I'm with you on the no poison thing. No poison. I mean, poison's bad for a number of reasons. Not only can it sneak up your house, but if something like a hawk or an owl then eats that mouse, then that hawk or owl also dies. And that's not very good either. That's pretty bad for the ecosystem in general. So,
and we're way off cars. I'm so sorry. But yes, I tend not to do the poison. I'd rather just release it somewhere.
We're ecologically responsible drivers is what we are.
Here we go.
There we are. Yeah.
And so, garage owners where the cars live.
Tim, one last question for you.
Okay.
Is a hot dog a sandwich and why?
Yes, it's a sandwich. There's meat, there's bread, the twain have met, and therefore we have a sandwich.
You know, it's just a pretty straightforward standard answer. I think that's right. Yeah.
But everybody has given the similar of meat and bread to some variation. What about sandwiches that don't contain meat?
Yes, like the cheese sandwich.
So you're the veggie sub.
But it's called
still a sandwich. It's really anything between two pieces of bread.
Right.
And I think the original Earl of Sandwich would agree.
There we go. There we
go. So should we then, Tim, let me get your opinion here. You think that would be better for us to ask if pineapple belongs on pizza?
That's a much better question.
All right. So Tim, question number 5, does pineapple belong on pizza?
No. There are no pineapples in Italy that I know of. So therefore, pineapple does not belong on pizza.
But there's no, wait. This logic does not hold, Tim, because how did pizza get to America?
It's migratory.
Right.
Now I have Monty Python in my head.
What's the average speed of an airborne pizza?
Right.
It could grip it by the husk.
Right. If the ingredient is not native to Italy, then it shouldn't be on a pizza.
Are anchovy? I guess anchovies are native to Italy. Okay.
So no French fries on a pizza. I don't know.
Right. And I'm looking square at you, Mr. Spam.
Tim has spoken. So there we go. There we have it. Thank you, Tim. Thanks for your answers. We're going to switch gears here and move to our next segment, which is currently called Dawn Drives the Decades. Dawn, take it away.
Thank you so much, Mickey. I have been having so much fun thinking about the decades of where some significant things have happened for cars. And I went almost literally 60 years ago, 1960, what we saw was a huge demand for smaller vehicles. And so automotive companies were starting to produce things like the Ford Falcon and the Chevrolet Corvair and the Plymouth Valiant, which then the Lincoln Mercury released the Comet and the Dodge and the Dart. And I think that's really fascinating because at the same time, if you think about the early 60s, that meant that smaller cars, lighter weight, they were replacing cars, steel with aluminum. And all of that adjustment, you know, required, there were adjustments in the combustion chamber. The alternator came on the scene. Fuel economy got better. And in just all of those different things. And then I think 60 years before that, even another, you know, major sort of timeline, we were just talking about the Model T, but actually in 1903, which was, you know, 57 years before the 60s sort of made a major change in what we saw in cars, was the Model A, And, you know, Ford is had actually incorporated in 1903. There were 12 investors, 1,000 shares. They had put about $28,000 of cash. And when by the end of the year, they had turned a profit, actually October 1st, 1903, they turned a profit of $37,000.
Huh.
So yeah. I was thinking about like how we look at, you know, over the time, 60 years and then 60 years later, some really interesting things were happening, but there had to be seen things that kind of teed it up. And speaking of racing, in 1901, Henry Ford actually defeated the top race car driver of the year. And then if we were thinking of the 1960s, the incredible interstate highway system, called the Dwight D. Eisenhower National yeah. System, that was actually the Federal Highway Act was passed in 1956. So there were always precursors kind of looming in the background to force change into that next decade. And I'm wondering, you know, as we're looking at 2020, what are some of those things that have been teeing up over the last year or two, including, you know, these autonomous drivers, the fact that this year I was finishing up my taxes last week and noticed how little driving I've been doing during the pandemic. I mean, we're talking by this time last year, I probably had 12,000 miles on the vehicle, on one of my vehicles, and maybe 5,000 on another one of my Mercedes. But this year I have like 1,000 on the coupe and, or the convertible, and yeah. barely 4,000 on the SUV.
Wow. Hmm.
So I wonder what the impact is like, you know, when you think about gasoline and car manufacturers and replacement parts, notwithstanding the window that won't come up in my back seat of the convertible, but other things we're not, you know, what's the whole impact and where are we looking going forward? Which is, we talked about, you know, did we actually see, you know, cars that are going out that they're not going to be making anymore? So that's kind of my overview of the 60-year increments of the decades. And I was wondering if, Ben, you would take on the whole alternator thing and like kind of wax on the interesting thing for that, because it was first installed in that Chrysler variant.
Yeah, well, I mean, they are, you know, lighter and usually smaller than the generators that preceded them, and they work a little better too.
And are they, I mean, technically AC instead of DC, and they have to get converted over? The voltage gets converted over? Am I right about that?
Well, yeah. The car is still a DC system. It mm-hmm. gets inverted and converted and yeah.
Yes, that's why they call it an alternator. Produces alternating current, and the old ones had external rectifiers to convert them to DC. That obviously changed fairly early on, but my dad told me about a car my grandpa had, I think was a 55 Chevy, was the first one in his small town in Ohio to be converted to an alternator, which was a hot aftermarket accessory at the time. And it had this external rectifier that was a big, huge finned thing that, you know, needed lots of cooling air that had to live right behind the grill.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, that was part of it. It was that those rectifiers that did the conversion. It was that there's just this, the alternators were faster and really lighter. So all of those things kind of lended itself to the new types of cars that were coming about in the 60s.
Right. Yeah.
But it's still at the end of it, when the power's going out, it's still considered a DC system.
Oh, right. Sure. Yeah. Right. That never changed. Of course, the great thing about alternators coming in at that point is all the electrical accessories that were starting to show up, you know, electric mm-hmm. windows, electric convertible tops, things like that. And, you know, and the alternator charges much better at lower RPM and even at idle. So, right. and idling is exactly when you're going to be putting the top up and down, things like that.
Yes. Don't put your top up while you're driving down the road.
Yeah. I've done it before. So, yeah, not a good idea. You don't realize you put your elbow down and there it goes. Okay. So here's a question for everyone. And I'm trying to figure out which way to ask this. Let me start with saying, what was very unique and a first on the Chevy Corvair?
Fire extinguishers.
Brake failure.
Oh, this rings a huge bell.
It's a mechanical advantage that was only It was an American first on the Corvair.
I feel like it's
a little flip differential.
Nope. Boy, I did ask it the right way. You guys aren't getting it.
No, I feel like I should know this from a good old fashioned car trivia point of view, and it's something like the way the engine got cooled or something like that, and I can't remember what it is.
Well, it's the first American air cooled motor, but I don't think that's the road we're going down, right?
Yeah, probably not really the first.
You're in the right equipment, and where is it in the Corvair?
Well, it's the first mid-engine American car, or rear engine.
Rear engine, exactly. First rear engine car made in America was the Chevy Corvair.
Uh-huh.
And that rolled out in the 60s. Yeah. So our last bit of information, this won't be trivia, is the standard price at that time in 1960 was $1,795 for a Rambler American sedan. And on the other end of the spectrum was the limited edition Cadillac Eldorado Brougham. I hope I said that right. It was $13,075.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Jeez, man.
Yep.
Price tags.
Yeah.
Yes, but then we talk about what standard salaries were back then, and you choke even more.
Right. Yeah.
But interestingly enough, a lot of people, I mean, they were getting these vehicles, and with the interstate system expanding, and I think about, you know, being in Pennsylvania with the turnpikes, people would just go out for a drive. I mean, they were out in their cars having picnics, going visiting folks. I mean, that was what they did.
That's what they did.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay.
People also still went on family vacations in their cars. My mom talks about her and her family driving from Michigan to the Grand Canyon because people did that.
Yeah. Yep. They did. Yep.
So wait, people don't do the family road trips across the country? I mean, never mind pandemic, but people don't.
Yeah.
They get on the airplane though. I mean, they don't get in the family station wagon and drive for days. They get on an airplane, they go somewhere with a resort or who knows and fancy accommodations, and you know, they don't rough it in the car.
So you're saying National Lampoon is now is anachronism. National Lampoon vacation is now an anachronism?
I don't know.
I think that's a great question. I think they're going to see the rise of the road trip, possibly. I hope so.
Yeah, actually, a couple of weeks ago, my brother-in-law took his family, but they rented an RV, but went from Atlanta to the Grand Canyon and back. Same but different.
It's not a bad way to do a trip. You know, if there are things along the way you want to string together, it can be a blast.
It is a blast. Oh my God, it's such a blast. All we've had is RVs my entire growing up life, and it was incredible. We did the Grand Canyon. We did everything out west that you can think of, the Painted Forest, the Petrified Desert. I think I got those backwards.
There's like certain family traditions that just have to happen by, you know, via a road trip, via an actual long road trip. And
of course, there was over the river and through the woods to grandmother's house you went every... Mm-hmm. Once, you know, every quarter, because you got to go see the grandparents and Thanksgiving and Christmas, where, you know, you showed up in the car and unpacked and slept on the floor in someone's room.
Well, you know, we'll have to encourage folks to continue to keep the American road trip tradition alive. But for now, we're going to move on to our listener viewer mail segment. Thank you, Dawn, for, you know, Dawn across the decades.
Yep, absolutely.
I have only one listener slash viewer mail item of viewer mail today. And it's from my friend Banu. Banu wrote to us. He says he has a story that he actually has to share in here, but he preceded it with the question. He says, please share a story about a repair that you took on yourself that ultimately cost more in tools and time than it would have if you'd just gone to the shop. And did you ever reach a point where you, where you said, I'll need to use this tool again in the future, and that ever became a reality? He says his story was, he was replacing the $30 clutch cable while he was living in New Mexico. It took him close to $300 and 4 hours of time underneath the steering wheel in a 100-degree plus day. He has full set of Torx screwdrivers that he never used again as a result. And he says, in fact, now they no longer even make Saabs anymore. But I was wondering if any of us had similar stories that you bought a tool for one thing and you never look back at it again. I don't have anything in my in my garage that is just that ended up being just a one time use thing.
Well, kind of a stupid little thing, but back in the 1980s, I remember buying a air conditioning, you know, refrigerant recharge, you know, hose and adapter, a little thing you screw onto the top of a can of R12 and connect to your car's air conditioner to recharge the refrigerant. I used it once, sat in my toolbox for years and years and years and years, eventually got thrown out. And then a few years later, I needed one again.
I hate when that happens.
And I had to, you know, trawl around eBay, eventually found another one.
Right.
I used that one once.
I have a full set of tools and all kinds of stuff for AC refrigerant stuff, but obviously it's not the R12. It's the, 134A?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The modern stuff, yes.
Yeah. Right. So, but it comes in handy, especially with three older cars, you know, the manifold pressure tools and all that. I can't think of anything. I have a ton of tools. Some of them are very, very specific tools, but I can't think of anything that hasn't been useful again.
I mean, I have some speed outs that I've never used, but you know, that's not why you get speed outs because I guess some people do need them when they get them, but I saw them for cheap. I'm like, you know, I might need those someday. So I picked them up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, it's actually one of the, I can't think of a tool that I have, same thing that I've never had to look back at again. We have also have a bizarre number of tools down in the basement. And yet somehow the most valuable tool in this entire house is a fondue fork.
Oh, are you like me where you've tried all the tools and then it's something stupid that works the best?
Yes, it's like something stupid, especially for something small and delicate. And you know, it's we've got everything down here that we could actually build a Bradley assault vehicle in our basement. Yeah. Nice. And before we start it, somehow I would have to say, you know, go get me the fondue fork.
Right. That's too funny.
I'm the
if
same
all
way.
Fails, fondue pork.
Yeah, I have in my collection of tools, because I would have left it there, some really bizarre things, one of which is a pencil. And I don't know if you guys remember, this was back when the Pontiac was having issues, but wasn't off the road yet. And there was this stupid oil filter. I'm using the wrong word. It's not the filter you change, but it's the little tiny... What's the word I'm trying to think of, Ben?
Breather?
No, it goes into an oil line. You know what I mean, though, right? Filter works, but it's not the technical term. You'll get corrected if you use it. So it's this little tiny thing. It's back behind the engine. It's down below the oil pressure sensor. And they give you tips on, you can buy this $387 tool to get it out. And then, or you can buy some picks to get it out, which I have picks. I tried to get it out, didn't work. Out of frustration, I jammed a pencil eraser in there with the pencil, and damn it, it was the best thing ever, because boom, that eraser grabs onto it, yanks it right out of place. It's awesome. So pencil.
Well, I mean, to steer the thing back to Banu's question, it's like, you know, where do you draw the line personally between buying a tool to do it yourself or just paying a shop to do it, and not just based on ability, right? Because it sounds like all of us are at least handy enough to tackle certain things in our own garages. But for another person, you know, it took him $300 and 4 hours of time and an oven to change a $30 clutch cable. It probably would have cost him, I don't know how much it would have cost him to take the saw in for an actual professional to change the same clutch cable.
But he doesn't say how good did he feel when he was done doing the job. Because sometimes it's about that too. Accomplishing it, learning new. Yeah.
Yeah.
Gratification's there. I think this is one of the best benefits though of the internet is before I do anything now, I go type in, is it worth it to do X, Y, and Z myself? Right. And if 5,000, you know, if basically if Yelp gives doing it yourself 1 star, I'm like, screw it, it goes in the shop.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or there's the other problem where you take your car in to have new tires put on it and everybody's asking you for the lug nut key. And you're like, you're a tire shop. Aren't you supposed to have that? And they're like, no, you have to have it. It's unique for your vehicle. I'm like, really?
Well, the thing is, they're not all unique anymore. Most shops do have standardized sets of keys.
You would think, but it took us like two hours to finally find that daggone key.
Wow. Okay. Well, anyway, thank you, Banu, for the question. I hope we answered it. And Tim, as always, Tim, thank you for being such a great friend of the show and being a good contributor for us. We really appreciate it when you're around. We'll have to do this again and again.
I appreciate it. Yeah. It's always fun.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's close out the show by answering our Grand Trivia Auto question. The Grand Trivia Auto question was, what animal sometimes appeared, often in groups of three, on Ford badges from the 50s to the 70s? Was it bears, birds, chupacabras, or cats/tigers? Tim, you want to go first?
I'm going to guess felines.
Felines. Becca?
I'm going with the cats as well.
Dawn?
Yeah, because I remember when my uncle was selling Fords that they used to have a big tiger in a cage, which was sad, but that was like a big promotion thing. Like you could come and see this tiger. So I'm going with cat, the tiger.
Ben?
Well, as much as I'd like it to be chupacabras, my gut says birds.
Birds? Okay, Ben says birds. Dave, what do you think?
I'm going all Andrew Lloyd Webber on this one. Cats for the win.
Very cool. The answer is actually cats.
Huh.
It was actually a trio of felines, large cats at one point. And
so big cats, yeah. Not kitten cats.
I'm pretty sure, right. Yeah, not tabbies. Not,
yeah. Yeah, not orange tabbies, but actual like tigers. Or
yeah, they released a cougar, not a tabby. Yeah.
Not a Felis Sylvestris.
Right, exactly.
The domestic house cat.
Yes. Right. Yes. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, cats, tigers, great.
Very cool.
Yay. Oh, I see this now. Yes, I just looked it up. I see it.
Now, if you had offered us horses as an answer, I would have chosen that.
Well, Mustang, Ford has a history exactly of using animals because you've got the Thunderbird for Ben's bird, and then yeah, lots of horses: the Mustang, the Pinto, the Bronco. Those are all horses.
Well, this one's not model specific. It's just kind of a crest thing.
I just wanted to say chupacabra, actually.
Yeah. Right.
They would have had that in the cage next to the Thunderbird in the cage.
Exactly. Poor chupacabras. So, as always, thanks to everyone for joining us for this episode of The Thing About Cars. We always value your suggestions and questions and comments. And it means a great deal to us when you rate us. If you go to Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or wherever you catch the show, your rating actually gets us more attention and might even get us featured on Apple's podcast list, which would be a huge deal for us. So if you have a minute, please take the time to spare us a rating and tell your friends about us. And we will see you in another week with another episode of The Thing About Cars. And in the meantime, hope you and yours are all staying safe and happy. Take care. Be careful, you guys.
Bye.
Later.
Drive
Bye.
Well.
Bye.
Listening. This has been The Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road.